last year, our Shelby County CIPA team reviewed well over 3,500 reports of abuse. I want to say actual number may be north of 3,800. We know that child sexual abuse is vastly underreported, so that 3,800 does not encompass all the children that are being harmed in our community here in Shelby County. You know, our incident rate for child sexual abuse in Shelby County is about double the national average. So the national average is around 1 in 10 children will be sexually abused before they reach the age of 18. Here in Shelby County, we're about double that. So two out of 10 children in our community will likely be a victim of child sexual abuse before they reach the age of 18. So, you know, we're out educating the community.
I want to get started today by sharing a story. Actually, it's a personal story about my life, and it does relate. So just hold on. When I was in eighth grade, I was having a wonderful day, and lo and behold, I got a call when I was sitting down in my class from the front office, and they wanted me to get my stuff, and I was going to check out. So I come up, I was a little bit surprised, I came up to the front office, and there was a stranger there waiting for me, and I did not know who that person was, but they checked me out of school, and they took me to a building, a white building with a yellow door. And I went into that building, and they told me I was going to talk to someone, and they were going to ask me some questions, that I wasn't in any trouble. But of course, yes, I was pretty nervous. Mm-hmm. The lady offered me a juice box. I was in the eighth grade, and I was like, what? But as I got in there, someone was asking me some questions about some students in one of my classes that was in danger, and they had told me, and I had told my dad. So I had a forensic interview about what I had observed and what I had heard. And yeah, I was at the Child Advocacy Center, and I had a forensic interview. So
is that what prompted your work?
It is.
It is.
It okay. changed the trajectory of my life.
Major life event. Yep.
Yep. That's the reason that I went into social work. That's the reason my first career was in forensic interviewing. It forever changed me for the better. And I'm so thankful for that experience, that I actually got to experience that, because I have a little insight on what it's like to go through that. Even though it wasn't my own trauma, it was still something that does impact me and did impact me at the time. So we have the Memphis Child Advocacy Center here today mm-hmm. to talk about child abuse. It is Child Abuse Prevention Month this month. This is important.
Oh, it's super important.
What is it? 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 4 boys will experience abuse before the time that they reach 18. So this is relevant, and it's heavy. But we encourage you guys to listen in, glean today. And also, if you have experienced abuse, you're not alone. And we'll link some resources and some support here too for you today.
So without further ado, here is Mr. Chris Krim.
Chris, I did see you at the Stewards of Children training. And when I saw Chris, I was very impressed with the training in itself, but then also just your presentation and your passion. So can you tell us who you are and what you do?
Yeah, my name is Chris Krim. I'm the Director of Operations here at the Memphis Child Advocacy Center. I just started in this role almost a year ago, not quite a year ago, but almost a year ago. And so prior to that, I was our prevention director, overseeing our outreach education programs for the center. Primarily, that means our Stewards of Children training, which is a child sexual abuse prevention and response training that we provide in the Shelby County community. It's also provided by a number of other CACs across the state and across the nation. And it's used by other folks as well. But Stewards of Children is all about educating adults how to prevent child sexual abuse from happening in the first place, and then also how to appropriately respond should an adult or a caregiver have any suspicions that a child is being abused sexually. So it's really about giving and equipping adults with information about how to keep kids safe.
Can you tell us about the child advocacy model?
Yeah, I may not be the foremost expert on that, but I will do my best. But in a nutshell, it's really all about bringing together the various parties or entities that are working on these child abuse cases, particularly sexual abuse or severe physical abuse. It's really about bringing all the players together. In Memphis, we're very fortunate to have a campus or a facility where we can actually have not only that collaboration and take place on a, you know, for meetings and such, but we actually have the Memphis Police Department's Juvenile Abuse Squad. Having all these folks work out of the same campus or the same buildings is really a great thing, because the colleagues that are working on these cases and, again, trying to seek justice for these children, they're able to just get up and go walk down the hall and speak to a colleague who's working on the case with them and get answers very quickly. When they have meetings, they're able to all sit down around a table together and review these reports and start working on these cases, or do what we call our case review update meetings on Thursdays. So again, having a facility and a space where we can have so many of our partners actually co-located with us here on site is a really wonderful thing. But the Child Advocacy Center brings together a number of different pieces. What I just spoke about is the Child Protection Investigation Team, or CPIT team. That team is mandated by Tennessee state law. So all 95 counties in the state of Tennessee have to have what's called a CPIT team, or Child Protection Investigation Teams. We have a CPIT team here in Shelby County that is the most active team in the state, based on the number of reports and referrals that our team receives. So last year, our Shelby County CPIT team reviewed well over 3,500 reports of abuse. I want to say the actual number may be north of 3,800. Again, that is by no means representative of all the children that have been harmed in our community in the last year, but those are the situations where a report has been made, where an adult had suspicions that a child was being abused or had information about that, or a child made a disclosure to an adult about their abuse. So again, we know that child sexual abuse is vastly underreported, so that 3,800 does not encompass all the children that are being harmed in our community here in Shelby County, but those are the situations and the reports that we are investigating and attempting to follow up on. So I think the closest county to us by number of cases or reports is Davidson County, the Nashville area, and they're about half of what we have in Shelby County. So really, there's no other county in the state that is seeing the volume of reports that we're seeing here in Shelby County. So, you know, our incident rate for child sexual abuse in Shelby County is about double the national average. So the national average is around 1 in 10 children will be sexually abused before they reach the age of 18, which that equates to about 400,000 children born in the U.S. this year, which is staggering and concerning. Mm-hmm. Here in Shelby County, we're about double that. So two out of 10 children in our community will likely be a victim of child sexual abuse before they reach the age of 18. So, you know, as we're out educating the community about, you know, through Stewards of Children, educating adults, that is why this conversation is of the utmost importance, particularly in our community, because we know that so many children are being abused and harmed. And so we need adults who are better prepared, who know the signs to look for, to know how to respond, to know how to make a report. All that information that may seem on the surface that almost everyone would know, we actually find through our pre and post test and Stewards of Children that there's a lot of information that's gained through this training. A lot of adults are not aware, even professionals who work in this field. It really is helping and equipping our community to better create a safety net for children, and for us all to be equipped to look out for the safety of children in all different types of settings, in our homes, in our houses of worship, in sports programs, in schools, daycares. Really, any space where children spend time is something that needs to be safeguarded. Another thing that occurs at the Child Advocacy Center is our forensic interviews, and those are done at the courtesy of the Department of Children's Services and the law enforcement entities in Shelby County. So those forensic interviews are done in a child-friendly environment by professional, highly trained forensic interviewers who are staff members of the Child Advocacy Center. Mm-hmm. And they typically do around, you know, over 1,000 interviews per year. Mm-hmm. Those interviews are recorded and admissible in court as evidence if the case makes it to court, if that's needed. But the whole goal of that is to not re-traumatize the child and to not have them be interviewed multiple times. Right. And also to be interviewed by someone who's specifically trained to interview children who have experienced this particular type of trauma.
I'm overwhelmed with just everything that the Child Advocacy Center does. So I want to go back. We were talking about how basically the Child Advocacy Center is a one-stop shop. So they can get their forensic interview conducted there. And that's a time where they're only having to tell their story one time. So let's talk about when a child walks into the Child Advocacy Center. What is kind of that first thing that happens?
Yeah, so they would typically be greeted by a victim advocate, and the victim advocate would kind of, you know, meet with them and their families. Obviously, there's some intake paperwork that's completed. The victim advocate would explain the forensic interview process and take the child, you know, to their forensic interview for the first time and kind of explain to them what's going on. Likewise, they would you know, update the parents and caregivers as well about the process and what's going to happen that day. As I've learned over the years, it's really a blessing for the Shelby County community that the Memphis Child Advocacy Center has some forensic interviewers who've been in this line of work for many, many years. And right, so we have one forensic interviewer who's been with us over 20 years and two others that have been well over 10 to 12 years of experience. And so that is not the case at every child advocacy center. And that's nothing against anyone else. But I just want you to know that here in Shelby County, we are extremely blessed to have highly, highly qualified forensic interviewers who are wonderful at guiding children through this process and helping the investigators collect the information that they need to hopefully successfully, you know, seek justice for these children and families. So, you know, you can imagine what our forensic interviewers hear on a daily basis, mm-hmm. what our therapists hear on a daily basis, what our advocates hear on a daily basis. And so to have staff who've been able to had the resiliency and the dedication and the desire to continue to do this work very long term, given the nature of what they see and experience every single day, right, is really remarkable. And so, again, I can't highlight enough what a blessing that is. And they're very happy to be meeting with someone who understands what they're going through, who's helping them. They develop a wonderful relationship with their therapist over time and with their victim advocate. We have many clients who return to the center after they have graduated from our therapy program, you know, years down the road, to mm-hmm. say, hey, you know, I got my learner's permit, I got my first part-time job, I'm graduating high school, I got my first college scholarship offer, whatever the case may be. They're coming back to just sit down and chat with their therapist to talk about all the good things that are happening in their lives. So, you know, one thing I like to remind people is that, you know, this is very much a place of hope and restoration. It's not just a sad place. I mean, we certainly, you know, are very concerned about why children are here in the first place and how they arrived at our doorstep. And that's very unfortunate. But we are trying to help children heal and help these families heal and help them move past this in a positive way, along with assisting the investigators and seeking justice. So that's really what the Child Advocacy Center is all about.
You all are doing great work down there. And it's so refreshing to hear the amount of services and support that you all provide to the children here in our county. I do have a question. I wanted to kind of go back to what you said earlier about the number of cases here in the county. So that number was alarming, and you said it was larger than the Nashville area, correct?
Yeah, it's okay. By far and away the highest reporting. So Tennessee has 95 counties. Shelby County is by far and away the highest reporting in the state.
So I'm wondering if it's we've been just been educated more, or are the other counties maybe underreporting? And with that, what are some things, if they are underreporting, what are some warning signs people should be looking for to make sure that these babies are taken care of and have the support they need?
Yeah, so a couple of caveats with the numbers, and you brought up a very good point. You know, obviously Memphis and Nashville and Knoxville and Chattanooga are, you know, more metro areas, and we're going to have higher reporting than a rural county, obviously. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Right.
We do feel like we've educated more adults, although we have trained here at the Child Advocacy Center about 30,000 unduplicated adults in Shelby County from around 400 different organizations or entities. That's, you know, churches, daycare, schools, you know, youth serving programs, nonprofits, parent groups, you know, really any group of adults we can get in front of, particularly adults who are working with or around children, is really important. So, you know, we've trained at what sounds on the surface like a lot of people until we consider there's 700,000 adults in Shelby County. So, you know, saying that the Memphis AC has trained 30,000 adults, which is, you know, the highest number in the state as far as counties as adults trained, we've merely scratched the surface. So there's so much more to do and so many more adults to educate. So we do know that some of our numbers we feel like are based on, you know, our progress towards our tipping point here in Shelby County, which is a short-term goal of training 5% of the adult population. And for us, that's about 35,000 adults. So we are inching ever closer to that number every day. But again, that is merely scratching the surface of what we feel like we really need to do to, you know, have this culture of safety and the safety net in our community that we know needs to exist. And so there's a lot more work to be done. We also know that abuse can be generational in nature, and that certainly has permeated and existed in our community for a very long time. It's certainly something we see in our area of the country where, you know, we don't talk about things that occur within the home, outside the home. Mm-hmm. or we don't talk about things that happen within our church, outside of our church. And so, you know, we certainly are fighting some battles there. But you're right. Our numbers are certainly quite a bit higher. And, you know, that's, it's good that there are additional reports being made, but we know that there's so many reports that are never made.
Right.
And we know based on our population that a lot of this is being missed, and that a lot of children, their abuse is never discovered. And as you said, it's important to know the signs to look for. And so one thing we educate adults about in our Stewards of Children training is that the physical signs are not always common. As a matter of fact, oftentimes they are not. And that could be because the physical signs would be covered by clothing. So given our relationship and the nature of how we're working with this child, it's not an area of their body that we would be privy to. But oftentimes, even outside of that, it could be because the abuse happened days, weeks, or months ago. So the physical signs are really important. So if we see things like bumps or bruising or redness or bleeding or spots we're not sure about, we definitely want to notify the proper authorities and have the investigators check into that matter, ensure the safety of the child during that time. But what we educate adults about through Stewards of Children is that we really have to be attuned to, in addition to obvious physical signs, which are not always present, but we have to really be attuned to those emotional and behavioral changes in children.
Right. So what does that look
and
like?
And that is, yeah, so that's really what we have to be, you know, tuned into. And that requires a little more effort on our part, right? So that could be things like changes in behavior. A child who was once very excited about going to a certain program or an activity or going with someone who now seems very reluctant to do so. It could be a child's conduct in school or grades that are falling off. It could be a child who's demonstrating sexual language or behavior that is not age appropriate. It could be things like alcohol or drug use or runaway. It could be any number of those things. But, you know, if we see changes in a child's behavior that are concerning with us, you know, as caring, trusting adults in their lives, we definitely want to have a check-in conversation with that child to find out more about what's going on.
Now, the behaviors that you mentioned, are those kind of blanket, or do they differ from elementary to high, or...
Yeah, it really it's not entirely age specific. Obviously, you know, we like to think that the sexual language or sexual behavior might be children who are a little bit older. But as I often tell people, the reality in the world in which we live in today, those types of conversations and scenarios likely happen much, much younger than many of us, of us are prepared to talk about. So. You know, we talk about the ages of, you know, 7 to 8 is really when we need to begin having those conversations about sex and sexuality, because those are happening on the playground and in school. And, you know, whether we're prepared for it as adults or whether we're comfortable as adults or not, it's coming.
It's
right.
Coming. You're absolutely right.
The content, and the information that children have access to today is vastly different than what most of us grew up with, you know. Tablets and phones and gaming systems and, you know, social media, all that is, you know, an entirely different world that our children are exposed to and have access to that many of us, you know, never even imagined. So again, we're not saying download everything at age 4, but we need to begin start talking about the correct names for body parts and having those conversations about, you know, if anyone ever makes you feel uncomfortable, you know, I want you to come tell me, whether that's online or in person or at school or in your soccer program or gymnastics program or wherever you may be, if anyone ever makes you feel uncomfortable, and using those real world examples, you know, not just talking about stranger danger. And that's still a really important safety conversation to have with children in our lives. But that is very different than child sexual abuse and how child sexual abuse occurs.
Yeah.
It's no longer the creepy man in the white panel van who's cruising around the playground or the guy in the trench coat. Again, I'm not making light of that. That's still an important safety conversation, but that is stranger danger and abduction. That is not what child sexual abuse looks like.
Right.
So 90% of the time, children know their abuser. 60% of the time, it's someone that they and their family would say that they know very well. 30% of the time, it is a family member who's abusing this child. And 40% of the time, it's an older or larger youth. So that really gives us a really clear window as to what we need to be on the lookout for. It's is those individuals in those settings. So we need to use real world examples with our children. You know, if your teacher or your Sunday school teacher or your coach or your aunt or your uncle or your babysitter or this one's a little harder to say for sure, but if your mom or your mommy or daddy, if anyone ever makes you feel uncomfortable, I want you to come tell me, you know? And so we have to develop that rapport and that relationship with children so that they feel like they can have those conversations with us. So if they do experience something like that, you know, that they feel comfortable coming to tell us and that they have the language to be able to do so.
Mm-hmm. I love what you're talking about right here, that age appropriate language and giving them those tools. And that's really the biggest, in my mind, the biggest preventative action step that parents can really take. I think about back in my forensic interview days, it was at the very end of the interview that she made a disclosure, and it was a little bit more direct. The interviewer had to be more direct. The child did not have the language, so she could not communicate what had happened to her. And she was, you know, she was younger, she was itty bitty, and you wouldn't have thought, oh, she needs to know these things at this age. But because of that, she couldn't communicate the trauma that was happening to her. And that is I'm not blaming the parent, but how important it is that we use language so our children can communicate with us. And that's exactly what you're saying. So I love that. I think that is the most important step that a parent can take.
I think what we find is that, you know, for many of us as adults, it requires us to step out of our comfort zone, right? I mean, it's not an easy conversation to have. But again, if we can start those conversations early, it does make it easier. And using the correct names for body parts and talking about body safety and, you know, comfortable and uncomfortable touch, you know, those types of topics are of vital importance in keeping a child safe, and you're equipping them to help protect themselves. Again, we always say at the Child Advocacy Center that a child's safety is an adult's responsibility. Mm-hmm. So we're not putting the onus on the child necessarily. That's not where we have to, you know, that's not where we're going to park this.
So I noticed that you said uncomfortable touch. That's interesting. Using language like funny or weird or uncomfortable versus bad touch, good touch. Yeah. Why is that important?
Yeah, it's just something that we have found in our work at the Child Advocacy Center. Sometimes what, as adults, we would obviously know is a bad touch. You know, depending on what the child experienced, you know, good and bad touch can sometimes be confusing if they don't know how to register that or qualify that. So we like to use the terminology comfortable and uncomfortable touch. Mm-hmm. Did that touch or that interaction make you uncomfortable as opposed to good touch, bad touch? Yeah. I think, you know, on the surface, we many times as adults, we feel like good touch, bad touch is, you know, the language that we should be using. And it's not the worst thing in the world, but I think we found that comfortable and uncomfortable touch in our work seems to provide additional clarification and for everyone involved, including the parents and caregivers and investigators. So we like to encourage folks to start using that terminology early. Yeah.
I like that too, and it kind of takes the shame away and provides clarity for the child to be able to communicate that to their parents or you know, possibly the person that's interviewing them if some trauma has happened to them. So how can parents support their children if abuse has occurred?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing is if, you know, making sure that we make the report to the proper authorities. That is step one. In Tennessee and in Mississippi, we are all what's called universal mandated reporters, which means that anyone age 18 or older in our state has not only a moral obligation, but also has in our state a legal obligation to report any suspicions of child abuse or neglect. So whether you're a parent or not, or regardless of your profession, whether you are a school teacher or a barista at Starbucks or an associate at Home Depot or an executive at International Paper, regardless of your walk in life, if you're an adult in our state, you are a first responder, as I called it. We are all universal mandated reporters. So if we have any suspicions or any information that a child has been abused or neglected, it's our legal obligation and duty to report that to the proper authorities. And in Tennessee, there's a couple different ways to do that. We have a Tennessee Child Abuse Hotline. It's actually a phone number you can call. We also have a reporting website. And then I always like to remind folks, too, that in Tennessee, currently, we do have the ability to make anonymous reports as well. And so that is really important. So we often encounter adults in our trainings who say, you know, this is the situation I'm in, or I'm concerned about my job or my own personal safety, given that the abuser is a family member or someone in the household. In those situations, you can make an anonymous report. And so if If you ever find yourself being on the fence or unsure as to whether or not you would make a report or not, we encourage folks to strongly consider to at least make an anonymous report so the investigators can check into this matter further and ensure the safety of this child. Again, just because we're making a report does not mean that we are making an outright accusation. We don't have to have all the facts. We don't have to have a recording with the child on our phone. We don't have to have all the pictures or any pictures. You know, we don't have to ask detailed or pointed questions to the child. We are simply reaching out to the investigators and the professionals and asking for a professional service to be done. And so, you know, we just share what we know, what we've seen, what we've heard. We've seen something, so we're going to say something. We're going to notify the proper authorities, and we're going to let them take it from there.
I think that's what some people's reservation is not wanting to be identified, even though they have the suspicion, a reasonable suspicion or concern. I'm glad that you said that you can do it anonymously. And I'm glad that you pointed out that everybody is a mandated reporter. I think that's very important for people to know. We all have a right and responsibility to make sure that these children are safe and cared for and have the right support. So it has been an awesome conversation with you this morning.
I feel like I could keep talking. I know that we are almost out of time. I know we've talked about a lot and we really haven't covered everything at all, but this podcast, it mostly gears towards parents. So when we're thinking about children that have experienced child abuse and parents need support and they need care too, what advice would you give to parents? What support or encouraging thing would you say to our parents here that are listening?
Just parents knowing that a place like the Child Advocacy Center exists. There are other agencies that can provide support to, you know, adult caregivers as well. But we have a number of those resources that we can, you know, assist with or refer our families to through the Child Advocacy Center. So just getting folks here to our doors is really important.
Absolutely. And, you know, them knowing you guys are a resource and support and they're not alone and they don't have to do this all alone. The fact that you guys have a victim advocate that's going to come and walk beside them through this whole process is so important. And I think that can be very empowering for a parent. So finally, closing out, what can our community do to support the Child Advocacy Center?
Yeah, I think one of the things that adults can really help us is to just join this network of adults in our community that the Child Advocacy Center is creating, who are better equipped and prepared to look out for the safety of children. So if you've not taken our Stewards of Children training, again, whether you're a parent or not, or regardless of your profession, we need you helping us look out for the safety of our community's children, because you likely, whether you're a parent or not, or an aunt or uncle or not, you likely interact with children in some aspect or some part of your daily life or weekly life. So we need adults taking Stewards of Children so that they know what to look for and how to keep children safe. And they are helping us hold community organizations and youth-serving organizations accountable and asking those questions about child protection policies and code of conduct and things of that nature, screening. We have open enrollment sessions twice a month that any community member can come and participate in. Those are held virtually, so you can log on from anywhere. Those sessions are live and interactive and led by a live facilitator, but they are held virtually, so you can log on from anywhere and join us in that. We also spend a great deal of our time actually providing Stewards of Children training to various groups and organizations out in our community for their staff team or volunteer team or a combination of both. So if you'd like to have us come out to your church or school or sports program or any group that you're involved in with children to educate the adults about how to keep children safe, the Child Advocacy Center is here as a resource to be able to do that. So visit our website at memphiscac.org to learn more, but please reach out to us if we can assist with training at all.
Wow. Well, that we will definitely list all of that in our show notes after we get done here. But it has been such a pleasure speaking with you and having you on today, Mr. Krim. And we so appreciate and thank you and your team for the work that you're doing with our youth here in the county. So that was Mr. Chris Krim from the Memphis Child Advocacy Center. Wealth of information, a lot of information to take in and digest. So thankfully, this is a podcast, so you can rewind if you missed something and listen again. But one thing that stuck with me and that I'm kind of, you know, applauding myself for is he mentioned having frequent conversations with your children about boundaries, about naming your body parts and just having that conversation of what an uncomfortable and comfortable touch is really resonated with me, because I do that. I have two girls and I'm just super protective of them. And so I want them to know the correct body parts and names of things. So if something, God forbid, should happen, they are able to communicate what happened, where it happened, on their body and such, you know, and so on. So I'm glad that he said that. And as a parent, I'm like, okay, good. I'm doing that. We also have them in self-defense. They are brown and black belts in karate. So, you know, hopefully that will, you know, if something should happen again, God forbid, they can also protect themselves and kind of fight and get away, because they know how to do, you know, self-defense and all that, those type of moves to get away from things if they're feeling uncomfortable or threatened in the moment. So,
and I want to talk from a to the parent. If you have experienced physical sexual abuse, any type of abuse yourself, you know what I'm talking about when you told your person what happened to you and you were looking at them to watch and see what they thought or how they respond, and I how they responded. And I want to remind parents that our babies are looking at us, and there they may share a little bit of information just to see how we hold it. And I want you to remember, we've talked about this before, put your game face on. Don't overreact. This is not your fault as a parent. If you need to step away, step away, but get back to it. Be very neutral. Let your child share some information, and they may be testing you. There may be more. And we don't want to overreact in that moment, because a lot of times children will put the blame on themselves. And I'll tell you too, gray space, if you do overreact, a child knows you care, right? But be a safe place for your kiddo. This is hard. This is a hard topic. It's a heavy topic. Parents, if you had something happen to your child and you just can't believe it and you're shocked, you need supports too. So we'll link some different things in the show notes for you to look at for preventative, but then also just some supports for parents too.
Till next time.
The Pep Talks podcast is brought to you by Arlington Community Schools in Arlington, Tennessee.